We're saddened that two former guests on the Leonard Lopate Show passed away this week. Glenn Campbell had been an accomplished session musician before he became a star himself, recording guitar parts for everyone from Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra to the Monkees and Elvis Presley. He's known for hits like Gentle on My Mind, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and Rhinestone Cowboy. And Barbara Cook was a star of Broadway and cabaret. Her amazing, clear soprano voice won her a Tony in the original 1957 production of The Music Man, and she'd go on to be a key interpreter of Stephen Sondheim. For our bonus weekend podcast, we are revisiting Leonard's interview with Glenn Campbell in 2000 and his interviews with Barbara Cook in 2004 and 2008. Enjoy.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
There's no question that Glenn Campbell is a pop music legend. The mere mention of perfectly fine places like Phoenix and Galveston bring to mind his ringing tenor. And when many thought he was a voice from the past, Glenn Campbell turned Rhinestone Cowboy into a monster hit. Jimmy Webb is responsible for a number of Glenn Campbell's biggest hits, including By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Galveston. He's also a music legend in his own right, and I'm very pleased to welcome both of them, Glenn Campbell and Jimmy Webb, to New York and Company today. Hello.
Thanks a bunch.
Yeah,
appreciate
thanks, Leonard.
Now, Jimmy, before we get going, Glenn was born in a town called Delight, Arkansas. Are you born in a place with as colorful a name?
Well, I think I'll get in the running. Elk City, Oklahoma.
Oh, that's nice. Now, Glenn, although a lot of us picture you with a guitar in hand, you're more famous as a singer, and yet you really started your career as a guitarist, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, actually, with the Champs, and I played bass, though, with the Champs, but I started mainly...
Mean Tequila? Ba-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yeah, I didn't play on that record, but I was the road band, mm-hmm. where the big shots got 40% off at the top, you know. But I started in the studios, yes, with a guitar. That's
And you've recorded with Merle Haggard, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Ray Charles, the Mamas and the Papas.
Right.
Phil Spector. Spector used to use you, Jimmy Bowen. So that means that you could have had a career as a studio musician. Were you singing all along?
Oh, yeah. And between that and going out and taking Brian's place on the road with the Beach Boys and things like that. Yeah, but I figured, seeing the way computers were going and everything, I'm just so blessed that a song that I came out of a Studio 3 and doing a session, and I saw an old Johnny Rivers, it wasn't an old Johnny Rivers album on the wall, it was his latest release. And I saw a song called By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and I wonder if that's about that bird rising from the ashes. And that curiosity, when I heard the song, I cried because I hadn't been home for 3 years. Mm-hmm. I was homesick. And I said, any song that makes me cry, I'm going to record it.
Could
and
have been I By had the played Time I Get on, to Delight.
I had played on Pat Boone's record of By the Time I Get to Phoenix after that, before I recorded it.
Wow. So that had a real history before Glenn got it.
It was getting covered a little bit. I told Pat
the reason his wasn't a hit and the reason Johnny Rivers wasn't a hit is because they both said, she'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. That's not the correct
word. You know who else who cut it? I don't know whether you know this or not, Glenn, but you know Tony Martin cut that record when he was with Motown.
Now, Jimmy, have you ever thought about why one version of a record hits and not the other? It's usually the first version and then the superstar version.
Well, credit where credit's due. I think in the case of Burt Bacharach and Hal David, that they definitely found a voice for their music in Dionne Warwick. Mm-hmm. And Warwick, if you please. In my case, I was really waiting for a voice when Glenn came along and started doing my material. And there can be no doubt that there is a kind of a magical area where the voice of the singer and a songwriter's style come together, and we'd seen it so many times in the pop field, and it was just a case of us finding each other, and it was the right thing.
And yeah. then, and why those two cities, Phoenix and Galveston?
I say that was my Rand McNally period. I just throw a dart at the map of the United States, and wherever it landed, that would be the next song.
Anyway, I said she'll probably stop.
Much better.
Yes, much better than she'll probably stop. In love.
You changed the ending too.
I did.
You have us. A guitar here.
Yeah. She just didn't know I would really go. They went back to the dominant chord.
Oh, and I always thought that was very clever songwriting, Jimmy. You hadn't written it that way?
I just changed the chord for granted. Just didn't know I would really go.
Yeah,
I didn't like that.
He actually made a contribution to the writing of the song, which was... It's not.
Remember
we
that on your
earlier
royalty check.
Yeah, you told me that Frank Sinatra used to change a lot of the lyrics.
Used to do it all the time.
But
Glenn, you mentioned earlier that you replaced Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys. That's when he had his breakdown, and then for a little while you toured with them, and then you were replaced by Bruce Johnston.
Right.
He wrote. I write the songs, and nobody seems to know that.
I write the song and make the whole world sing. Well, Brian actually. Brian didn't have his breakdown then. That was a start of night. It was the end of '64. Well, December 22nd and 23rd, I filled in for him. He took off to write the Pet Sounds album, and he got that product finished, and that was like a 2-year operation. And I think between that and whatever happened to him, I think that's what caused the breakdown.
Well, have you ever thought about what would have happened if they had hired you full time?
Oh, they couldn't afford me.
I see.
No.
But, I mean, you would have had a very different life.
Well, after Phoenix and Wichita, then I had him as guest on the TV, on my TV show. Here's my old group, the Beach Boys.
Well, you also wrote Wichita Lineman, so we're really going all over the Southwest. But, Jimmy, you also wrote some songs that were made famous by others, like Up, Up and Away, Didn't We? And of course, a song that everyone wants to know the meaning of, MacArthur Park.
Yes, but they never will.
I talked to Richard Harris about what he thought that song meant, and he didn't have the foggiest idea.
Well, he wouldn't admit to it if he did, but no. I think we were talking the other day, last night, I was talking to some people about the fact that Frank Sinatra sort of excised the middle section out of MacArthur Park, which is really a song called After All the Loves of My Life. The whole classical, orientated movement feel of MacArthur Park is really suggested by a guy named Bones Howe, who mm-hmm. produced a group called The Association. And... So it was really a reflection of the sort of lyric writing of the hallucinogenic era, and we'll just leave it at that.
And Glenn, you never recorded that because that middle part just would have taken you too far out of your range. You sing.
Oh no, I recorded it.
You have recorded it?
Oh, I got the best record on it. No.
But I always say that.
I know what someone left my cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it because it took so long to bake it, and I'll never find that recipe again. I know what that means. It's hard to explain, but it's all about love and life.
Oh, okay.
It's all about falling deeply in love, and it'll be so hard to replace that love and to find that love again. Yeah.
And you come from a musical family, a rather big one, don't you?
Yes.
And guitar was played by everyone?
Well, all my older brothers... and they played a little guitar. They would play rhythm guitar and accompany themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But
12
kids.
I
kind of took it. 12 kids, boy howdy. 8 boys, 4 girls.
Did you ever write songs?
No, I never. Did
anybody in the family write songs?
No. I learned most of the early songs from Mom and Dad, you know. And they'd learn them from Gene Autry records or Jimmy Rogers records, you know. I remember. In a show the other night, I said, I want you young people out there that's maybe never heard of this, I want you to listen and see how many people sing along with me. And I went, "You are my sunshine," and the entire place started singing, "My only sunshine." And people were looking around like, you know, I said, there were songs that...
Written by a famous politician.
Yes, Jimmy Davis.
Was the governor of which state? He was the
Louisiana, I think.
Louisiana? Mm-hmm. Right.
In fact, that got him elected.
Yes, it probably did. But there's the old songs. I still remember, like the Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine and stuff that Mom and Dad sang, and that taught me. It was, God rest their souls. When they were alive, I'd bring them out on stage with me. And just they traveled all over, went to Europe with me, and they'd get up on the show, get up on the stage with me, and we'd do two or three songs, and they'd just tear the house down, literally.
So you really come out as traditional Southern sing style. Do you think of yourself as somebody comes out of bluegrass or whatever, or whatever the music would have been where you?
I would say folk more than anything. And we got what we got on the radio, and we were too far from Nashville to get to WSM that much. So it was mainly, I heard Glenn Miller and Frank Sinatra probably more than I heard country stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was a big fan of Jimmy Dickens and Eddie Arnold, and of course we didn't have electricity. We had a no battery radio, you know. Roger Miller said they never had electricity. We had to watch TV by candlelight. That's kind of the way we were. But it was such an incredible upbringing. There wasn't anything else to do except, you know, do your chores, and then we'd sit around and play guitar and sing.
And is that why you really don't seem to fit into any category? Some people might think of you as a country singer, others as a pop singer, but you seem to have recorded everything. And the only reason I think people think of you more in country terms is because of Rhinestone Cowboy.
Yeah, but that was the number one song period in 1975. Yeah,
but so. Also about being a fake country.
I got into jazz when I was about 16 years old. I got into Django Reinhardt and Stephen Grappelli in A Hot Globe of France. And that's.
Can you play like that?
Oh, sure.
On this guitar, or do you need different guitar?
Oh, well, this ain't very loud. Oh, sure, I can. You know what I mean? Okay. I hurt my hand last night, dadgummit.
Woody Allen should have known about this. He might have used it on the soundtrack of Sweet and Lowdown.
The best stuff they did, they recorded on wire in 1936 out of France, and it was just the most incredible stumbling.
Before that gets away, though, that Glenn was without a question the first crossover artist. He was the first guy to bring like a kind of country music into the mainstream. In fact, what were you telling me in the car just before about, you said that, which one of those albums you said got a Grammy for country and pop record? Which one was that you were telling me?
It was About Time to Get to Phoenix album.
And it got a Grammy for...
It won a Grammy in the pop field and won the Grammy in the country field.
And were you, so, when you were writing those songs, Jimmy, were you thinking of them as country songs?
I really wasn't, and I've never really thought of myself as a country writer, even though I don't have anything against it.
Oh, me neither.
But I think those are pop tunes, and I never really understood someone questioning the veracity of them, because I was born and raised in the country. So, yeah. I mean,
Oklahoma makes you a country artist.
The country.
Glenn, when you heard By the Time I Get to Phoenix, what made you know that was right for you? Do you have that experience a lot with songs?
I have with a couple of them. When I heard Phoenix, I cried because I hadn't been home for three years.
So you saw it in very personal terms, but not necessarily as a hit song.
But By the Time I Get to Phoenix, well, and the other thing too, you know, the loneliness. When I heard Rhinestone Cowboy on the radio, and I said that's such an incredible song. I'm kind of a lyric freak. Not freak. I'm a lyric. I like really, really, really good lyrics. And Jimmy's musical talent is just second to none. He marries a melody and a chord progression probably as good as any writer that's ever been.
But he didn't write Rhinestone Cowboy. Who?
No, Larry Weiss.
And who?
Oh, Larry Weiss. Oh.
And whose record did you hear?
I heard Larry's. It was an album cut station. It was on an album, mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe it. How it just floored me.
I'm curious. Why would Larry Weiss's record not make it? Because
released as a single.
Oh, so it was just an album cut.
Yeah, it was the same way with Phoenix. It was stuck in Johnny Rivers' album.
Let's take a little break. We'll come back with more with Glenn Campbell and Jimmy Webb. We'll find out what they're doing in town.
Thanks.
Thank you. Galveston. I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing.
You know, one of the things that I find so remarkable about Glenn Campbell singing is that every word is sung distinctly, clearly. And I wonder whether that's something that just started when you began, or was it because you love lyrics?
Well, I love lyrics, and I wanted to make sure that I said the word and said it in tune. And the other part, the singing, I really never paid any attention to that. Or how I phrased it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say the word correctly.
So the phrasing just came naturally as a consequence of what you were doing?
Exactly. And that song there, Galveston, Don Ho was doing the TV show, and he says, "Well, here, Glenn," he says, "here's a Jimmy Webb song I did. I didn't have any luck with it. Maybe you'd like it." And I played it, and you couldn't hardly stand to listen to it all the way through because he had did it like...
Galveston, oh Galveston.
Because Jimmy had written it as a ballad. And I said, "My God, I'll speed the record up just so I can get the words off of it, you know." And when I got the word lyrics off of Galveston and read it, I said, "If this song is not a hit for this time and not in my life on this earth," I said... And it's amazing. I got so much mail from the guys from Vietnam. The USS Galveston was a missile carrier cruiser, and the USS Wichita was a supply ship. And the guys would say they'd meet in the Gulf of Tonkin for Galveston would be getting supplies, and it would be blasting Galveston over its speakers, and the USS Wichita would be blasting Wichita Lineman. He said it's a wonder then they got blowed out of the Gulf of Tonkin doing that, but they did it.
Well, maybe the Viet Cong liked those two records. Now, what are you two guys doing in town together? Are you making a record together or doing some kind of live performance?
Should I start?
You start.
Well, a little while ago, it started at Glenn's 60th birthday party. We started playing a little bit together, just the two of us. Me on piano, him on guitar. And then we ended up kind of taking this down to Washington, D.C. for ASCAP and playing for a bunch of the distinguished members of Congress, congressmen and senators. We were reminiscing about who was there that night. Ted Kennedy was there, yeah. Orrin Hatch, Fred Thompson was there.
And John Kyle.
A lot of fine Bert, guys.
Hal David and Dionne Warwick.
Yeah, Dionne Warwick was there that night. And we were sort of doing our pitch for ASCAP, but Glenn and I had such a good time playing as a duo with no band and no accoutrement that the idea was kind of born to one day do an engagement together as a duo. So in essence, that's why we're in town. And
so you're going to be performing in a cabaret?
At Feinstein's at the Regency Hotel.
Right.
Thank God for Feinstein's because...
That's the only place left, huh?
It's just about the only place left.
Do you prefer to perform in the intimate setting? Because you've done so many concerts where there are many thousands of people out there, but there's no intimacy.
Exactly. Well, just to get to hang around him for a week and play, I might pick his mind and get three or four more songs out of him for an album or something.
Oh, you're so kind.
But we know so many songs, and to sing some of the stuff that's never been recorded even. We're just going to do what we really want to sing and play, you know.
He plays for thousands of people. I, on the other hand, am only rated for 300 people. Anything over 300 people, and I could have a serious hydraulic failure. So, I love the intimacy of playing to small groups of people personally. At least that's my rationalization.
Mm-hmm. I play a lot of private shows where people just want to have Glenn Campbell there at their wedding or at their anniversary, and they will have 200 people, you know, and it's really a lot of fun to play that.
It's like wonderful to play when you can see people's faces and their reaction really mirrors exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult for a concert audience today in a huge 20,000 seat venue like the Madison Square Garden or whatever to really relate to the little stick figures that are kind of moving around on
yeah,
stage.
Yeah, and really the bomb's good. Going off, right?
Yeah.
Well, you said you're going to try to find some of his songs that you haven't recorded before. I doubt that you're going to do Arnie's Letter. My wife ran off with a jukebox or one of those songs.
My wife ran off the jukebox. I never wrote.
You didn't.
I always meant to.
Isn't that from one of your albums, A Naked Ape?
It was just a track that I assigned to a cue from a film. I used to do stuff like that. I was a practical joker when I was in my 20s.
Well, how many songs have you written that have been recorded by other people?
Well,
and eventually by Glenn Campbell.
I don't really know, but let's say that if I had had 100 songs recorded,
okay.
I think that's a pretty good number. That's quite a few. And I think it might be something like that.
But probably. So many multiple versions of songs.
Yeah. Certain songs of mine have been covered extraordinarily well. I feel very, very fortunate, for instance, to have By the Time I Get to Phoenix, was recorded by Frank Sinatra. I can't go through. I remember... Probably the best recorded song I ever had was the infamous MacArthur Park. And just on one hand, I can say I know it was done by Maynard Ferguson, Don Ellis, the Four Tops, Tony Bennett.
But the two big hits were Richard Harris and Donna Summers.
Donna Summers had a number one with it.
She did that
but
disco
it was
also.
Really That's done amazing. By... 40 or 50. Oh, you know who recorded it? Don Novello recorded it as Father Guido Sarducci, which was really very, very funny. Very good.
I
did that with the London Royal Philharmonic in London.
I always gave permission for MacArthur Park to be used in the movie Airplane 2, where a bunch of people come running out of an elevator holding their ears. And I feel that it's best to have a sense of humor about your work and always kind of enjoyed laughing along with everyone else.
Linda Ronstadt's done a lot of your work. Carly
yes,
Simon has done some of
your songs. Yes, I had a good relationship with her. I did an album called Film Noir with Carly Simon where I really functioned as producer. But we did some lovely, lovely vintage tunes on that record. And... I've had an extraordinary life in the versatility of that my music seems to have in its application to all kinds of different people, and I love that.
Glenn, we keep on hearing you noodling at the guitar. Is that what you always do?
I noodle. I'm a noodler.
It's like some people who doodle all the time that they're talking. This is a way of
right.
taking care of your. The energy yeah. in your fingers?
Chewing gum, you know, blowing bubbles.
Yeah, it's amazing you don't write songs.
Especially guitar players. I mean, I've never really seen a full-on guitar yeah. player who didn't play with the guitar all the time.
I finally found an album. Somebody put a compilation together of everything that Jimmy and I have done together in Australia. And I think it's Amazon.com. And now I've got the Love Song album out. Mm-hmm. And
plus another record.
Plus Capitol released the greatest hits album, you know, and it's...
We like, opened with What a Wonderful World from yeah. the Love Songs album.
That was pretty.
Thank yeah. you.
I enjoyed
you
that.
And Louis Armstrong on
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Oh, I loved Louis' version of that. It was so good.
But when you started recording as a singer, you were often being backed up by the same guys that you used to perform with as a guitarist.
Right.
So do you have a different relationship with the bands you play with than most singers?
Yes, I would think so. I have that. I have the musician relationship that they wouldn't have with.
You can't get too puffed up with these guys.
No,
because
no.
they remember you.
Oh, they made fun of me, man. You know, they laugh. As the good boy, if I just lost, like Tommy Tedesco, Carol Kay, Bill Pittman, Hal Blaine, the drummer, and all of them, they just they were all just so thrilled that when the TV show started and the Glenn Campbell started selling a lot of records. And
the TV show was a summer replacement for the Smothers Brothers,
yeah.
and then they got canned, and you wound up with your own TV show?
Right.
Were you encouraging them to do the kind of material that was going to get them canned?
No, that was a whole different thing. They went on and they were on. My show was on Wednesday night. Theirs was on Sunday night, and this went on for about a year and a half. And then when they canned the Smothers, they was number one in their time slot. I inherited that number one slot because they put my show in there, which Tommy was the producer of my show, Smothers. He was a genius producer. And but they still hung on to that. Well, when you got writers like Steve Martin and Rob Reiner and Alan Thicke wrote for the show for a bit.
They're all writing for you?
Yeah. Tommy put them together.
Wow.
And all I had to do was just stand up there and say, hi, I'm Glenn Campbell, and sing my song and play my guitar. And it was a lot of fun to do.
And read from the teleprompter.
And exactly. Now my next guest, boy, I learned to do that good. I mean, at front, I was so nervous, man, I'd have to do 5 takes on, hi, I'm Glenn Campbell, welcome to the show. You know, it was just
but what about when you wound up in a movie with John Wayne? I'd imagine being in True Grit with the Duke, that would have even been scarier.
It was. I gave him the push he needed, though, to win his Oscar. He didn't have anybody to give him that shove he needed, I think, for True Grit.
Now, the music industry is notorious for ruining marriages and making family life generally impossible. You're very settled now, but there was a time when your married life was in the newspapers. When you were with Tanya Tucker.
My dating life and my married life, right.
How did you work it out?
I quit doing it. I quit drinking, I quit smoking, I quit doing drugs, I quit. And married a mighty nice girl that I met here in New York City. We've been married 18 years now. But I quit doing it. I was on the road to hell in a handbasket, as they say. But Billy, God rest her soul, she was, I don't know what she was angry about. I brought Rhinestone Cowboy in. I'd been working on it, and it was kind of late. And I was sitting there listening to it in the den, you know, and she come in and said, are you going to release that stupid cowboy song as a single? And I says, yeah, I'm going to release that as a single, you know. And I said, there's the writing on the wall somewhere here that I'm missing, you know. And that was it, literally. For the marriage, for everything. And then all hell broke loose then, because I was on the road so much, you know. And when I got over to Scotland, I learned to like that scotch, the real single blend scotch. Yeah. And I did, and I can't drink, you know. I got Indian blood in me, man. I can't drink.
And Jimmy, is it rough for songwriters, or is show business easier for someone?
Well, let's
who
just say I have Indian blood in me too. My great grandmother was a full blood Cherokee. Yeah. So
my great great grandmother was.
Is that right? Yeah.
You didn't write Cherokee Nation, right?
That no. Was
we can't blame that one on you.
No.
Well, from tonight until Saturday, Glenn Campbell will be performing with Jimmy Webb at Feinstein's at the Regency Hotel at 61st Street and Park Avenue, and it's been an awful lot of fun having you on the show.
Thank you, Leonard.
It's not where you start, it's where you finish. It's not how you go, it's how you land. 100 to 1 shot, they call him a klutz. Can outrun the favorite, all he needs is the guts. Your final return will not diminish.
I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Barbara Cook first became famous in ingenue roles on Broadway. She played Cunegonde in Candide, was the original Marion the Librarian in The Music Man. However, over the last several years, she's established herself as one of the premier concert and cabaret performers, and she was even nominated for a Tony for her Mostly Sondheim concert at Lincoln Center. Now she is returning to the Lincoln Center stage in Barbara Cook's Broadway, which offers songs and memories of Broadway's golden age. I'm very pleased to welcome her to my show again.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm listening to you just now. I was thinking most singers' voices tend to get a little raggedy as they get older. But as far as I can tell, yours, if anything,
has mellowed and deepened.
Well, thank you very much.
So what happened? Do you have special, were you trained very well when
well,
you started?
Well, before we get to that, I have to talk to you about saying I was famous for ingenue roles. And it's interesting that you're not the only person who says that. Almost everybody says that. But the truth is, those roles were not ingenue roles at all. I think maybe the reason people talk about me in that way is because of the way I looked, you know. But if Cunegonde was a cartoon of in Candide was a cartoon of an ingenue, and in the end she's an old crone with a hump on her back, so that's hardly an ingenue role. And in The Music Man, for instance, I was about to become a spinster. My mother was afraid I'd never get married. And again and again and again, I've played these roles that are not really ingenue roles.
So you think of yourself as a character, a musical actor?
No, I don't know what I think of. I just did these
those
roles.
Because those are the more character parts.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me that I'm they still say I was the quintessential ingenue.
Well, that's because we like to think of the people who first burst upon the scene as playing ingenues, don't we?
I suppose. Then you asked me about my voice.
Yeah, your voice, which still amazes me.
Well, it amazes me, too.
Oh, is this just something lucky that happened to you?
Well, I suppose it's not all luck. I can't, well, of course, so many people ask me that now. A lot of singers ask me that. How did you manage this?
How, and can I do it, too?
Well, whatever, yeah. Part of it must be genes, I think. I have always had, thank goodness, tremendous energy, and I feel terrific in that respect. And I was given a really good vocal technique by a man I worked with for a long time, Robert Coben. I studied with him for over 10 years, and he's the person who really put my voice together and gave me this technique that I've been using, you ready, since 1953. So that's 51 years I've been using this technique. And I've never had any serious vocal problems, thank goodness.
Well, things have changed since 1953. In those days, when you performed in a Broadway theater, you didn't have any miking. You just had to project
That's
to the
right.
last row. And nowadays, everybody seems to be mic'd.
Yeah.
Has mic'ing helped you?
Well, particularly it's helped me in the kinds of things that I do now. If I were singing in the theater and had to project the way I used to, I think I would have some difficulty with that now. But the songs that I sing now in concert are songs that they're not necessarily such presentational operetta-type songs the way they were. You know, people used to write for the theater because they knew that there was no amplification. They wrote for singers where they would put the song where they knew they had natural power.
Uh-huh.
But they don't have to do that anymore. And
now you can go up to very high register or very low because the mic is going to take care of the projection.
But you can use a key that is more appropriate for the song.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense at
sure.
all? And a lower key generally for these kinds of songs because you don't have to project so much.
Well, I was looking over the list of songs that you're performing, and I was surprised that they're not from the shows that I associate you with. These are just the songs that you have come to love over the years?
Mm-hmm. For the most part, yeah.
And are they songs that you think are particularly well-suited to your voice, or just songs, or is any song okay?
If I didn't think so, I wouldn't be doing them.
Well, I mean, sometimes you might look at a song and say, I love that song. The way it's generally performed is not right for me, but I'll find a way to make it mine.
Yes, I do that. And also, I look at them and think, you know, I don't think I should sing that now. It took us at least a month, at least 4, maybe 5 weeks, to choose a long list of songs that which we kept winnowing away until we finally got what we have now. In fact, just before we opened, we cut 2 or 3 songs last week because we thought it was too long and it was stopping the flow of the show, we thought.
Well, so, it is a compendium of the great composers, Cy Coleman and Dorothy Fields, Kander and Ebb, Lane and Lerner, and Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Comden and Green, and Julie Stein. I mean, these are
a lot of good people.
Jerry Bach and
Stephen
Sheldon
Sondheim.
Harnick.
Don't forget Stephen. Stephen's in there too.
So these are the kinds of songwriters who you don't hear much from anymore. Yesterday we had Joseph Stein, who wrote the book.
Oh, for, did you?
Yeah, for Fiddler, and I asked him about the songs in Fiddler. You know, could you write those kinds of songs anymore? And he wasn't so sure. Even though I'm sure you can write those songs, but you don't know whether they'll resonate with audiences the way they used to.
Well, it's not just the songs either, is it? It's the whole ideas for the shows. All that whole concept has changed.
And what about performance? To nowadays, if you listen to the young singers, it's all about melisma and not about ever really thinking about what the song is about.
That does happen a lot, doesn't it? But melisma is a fad. It's, you know, it's the hula hoop of the musical industry today, I think. I think it's way, way, way overdone. And unfortunately, 90% of the people who do it don't do it terribly well, and they don't do it in tune. And, you know, I think it has a great place when it's done well and when it's used properly.
Well, you are often described as somebody who has emotional truth and simple clarity. So you do use melisma once in a while, but only if it makes a point.
I wouldn't say that I do. No. Not. You're talking about the gospelisms.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of
things
that
we hear from every young singer today, and if you watch some of those television shows where...
I don't know how to do that. No.
Well, we'll have a little lesson.
I guess if I had a song that called for it, I'd try to find a way to learn how to do it, but that's not something I do, no.
I'm talking to Barbara Cook, who is about to appear at Lincoln Center with
We've just
Barbara
begun
Cook's
our previews.
When did you start?
We started last weekend, Friday, Saturday. We played just the weekends, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays only.
The 9/11 hearings are resuming now, so our listeners on AMA 20 will be rejoining our special coverage. My conversation with Barbara Cook will be continuing here on 93.9 WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how long is this run going to go?
Through, I think it's April 28th. I believe that's what it is. We have 1 week that we're not playing during that time. We'll be in Alabama doing concerts there.
When you say we, you
Wally
have...
Wally Harper, with whom I've worked for 30 years now.
And you met him when you were on Broadway, weren't you?
I did. I met him. I didn't remember that, though. I did meet him then. He's reminded me of it, though. I didn't particularly remember meeting him then.
He's your musical director and arranger.
Yes, and good friend. It was not until the summer of 1973 that I feel I really got to know him.
And that was that when you were making the transition into your second career as a concert and cabaret
Well, not
performer?
Exactly. That whole summer and into the fall, I toured with Helen Gallagher and Harold Lang and Nancy Dussault. We did a concert based on the work of George Gershwin because it was his 75th birthday year. And that was very successful. And Wally visited us several times, and that's when I really got to know him.
And then there was that solo concert at Carnegie Hall in 1975.
Well, that came about because, well, Wally and I got together for the first time in February of 1974. And we played the very first performance we ever did of our stuff together was at the Eugene O'Neill Center, just one night. And word got around that we had put these songs together. And so there used to be a club on 46th Street called Brothers and Sisters. And they asked us if we would come in and put an act together and come in. And we were considered a sensation. And we stayed there much longer than we had expected. We stayed till the end of the summer then. And then Herbert Breslin, who handled Luciano Pavarotti, and, lots of other well-known classical artists saw our show there, and I'm the only non-classical artist that he ever handled it. And he's the person who got us that Carnegie concert and the first recording contract with CBS Records.
Now, there's a big difference between singing in a cabaret, the intimate room, and doing a concert in a place like Carnegie Hall or Lincoln Center. How much of an adjustment do you have to make?
Well, you know, I think so much of the adjustment is just automatic. It's not something you have to think about. It's a difference between you and I sitting here with just a few feet between us, and we're speaking, you know, in a moderated kind of way. And if you were across the street, I would speak to you in a different way, and I'd make larger gestures. So that's just an automatic thing that happens. It takes a little more energy, I think, to play in a big hall. But the basics are the same, as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think the acting background has had an effect on the way you perform in either of those cases?
I think so, very much so. It's something that I was not aware of particularly, and I'm sort of surprised. I particularly started getting these comments about acting. Well, I did before at the Carlisle often, but mainly when I started doing the Sondheim show a couple of years ago. People were saying, you know, each one, you're like a different character in each song. And it's not something that I'd set out to do. It's just the way I approach songs, I guess.
When you look back at your career, was there a time when you thought, well, I may never come back? I know you had some, there were times when you kind of dropped out of the business.
Yeah, I didn't ever think I would never come back again, though. I don't know. I'm such an optimistic person, and I have somewhere inside of me some very grounded place where I really trust me and trust me to get through things and survive. And even in the darkest moments, I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew somehow things would be okay. And thank God they have been.
Incredible. Well, did you come from a musical family?
No.
Did your parents take you to see shows?
Every now and then, yeah. And I'd come home, and I was like 4 years old. I'd dance around the house and sing and carry on, and you know, play all the parts.
And then you had this anonymous patron who really helped a lot.
Well, yeah. I was maybe 10 years old, and whenever I went into the barber to get my hair cut. My mother insisted on a little Dutch cut for my hair, the bangs, that old thing. And whenever I went in, he would ask me to sing for him. And he must have told one of his patrons about me. And I never knew who she was. She never wanted me to know, but she paid for music and transportation and voice lessons.
It's amazing how any number of people have had that kind of wonderful experience. Carol Burnett had an anonymous patron as well who helped her come to New York. You have to wonder what... She's an incredible talent. You're an incredible talent. One way or another, you would have probably have made it. But then you think about that generosity from people who don't even want to be thanked.
Yes,
it's kind of extraordinary.
Don't want to meet you, they just want to help. It's a wonderful thing.
So when did you know that you really wanted to not play ingenues on Broadway?
Oh, good, you got it. well, very early on. I think that's because of my being so in love with films. And the odd thing to me is that, believe me, if somebody offered me a film, I certainly would have taken it. But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do the shows that were in the movies.
And you started pretty much near the top. You played Addo Annie in the National Tour of Oklahoma, and then came Cunegonda in Candide, Leonard Bernstein, and an atypical musical at the time.
Yes.
Did you work closely with him?
Yes, we all did, absolutely. He was very often at rehearsals and telling us what he wanted us to do and so forth.
You were pretty much a beginner. It must have been a little scary at the time.
Oh, please. God, if there's anything as a pre-beginner, that's what I was as far as singing the role of Cunegonda goes. I had no... When I went in to audition for that, I saw the music for the first time and I saw all those high notes. And I kind of relaxed because I thought, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this. Because I'd never sung that kind of thing in public. I had practice that kind of thing with my voice teacher, who insisted on all of his students learning arias. But I never in the world thought anybody would hire me to do all of that. And I worked very, very hard and succeeded, they tell me.
And now you teach master classes as well at Juilliard?
Well, I don't do it on a permanent, steady basis, but from time to time, yes, I do. So and all around the world now.
What's the most important thing you try to impart to your students?
Well, let me just preface my answer with this, and it sounds grandiose, but actually what I do is give people permission to do what most of the time they already know how to do. It's just that they don't believe that what we want is them. So
everybody wants to be like the person he or she most admires.
It's a very common thing. Young artists go to museums and copy Caravaggio and stuff like that, which makes sense. And when we're starting out, we want to sound like Barbara Streisand or
Barbara Cook.
Price or maybe Barbara Cook. Do you know what I mean? But finally, what every audience wants and responds to profoundly is when they see somebody on stage really, really being present, who's really there.
And you will have that wonderful opportunity with Barbara Cook as part of Barbara Cook's Broadway, which she is performing at Lincoln Center through April 18th. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it very much. Good to see you again. Coffee is steaming, all the while I'm dreaming, when I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love. My baby likes bacon, so that's what I'm making, when I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love. Our life has been so nice and chummy, right from the start, when I want his tummy, I want his heart. My baby is happy, no wonder he's happy when I'm...
Barbara Cook began her career during a particularly exciting time on Broadway, creating the roles of Cunegonda in Leonard Bernstein's Candide and Marion the Librarian in The Music Man. She won a Tony for that one. Now, 57 years after her Broadway debut, Ms. Cook performs mostly as a solo artist and as a cabaret performer, and she joins me now to talk about her latest CD, Rainbow Round My Shoulder. Gives me great pleasure to welcome Barbara Cook back to the show. Hi.
It's really 57 years ago. Oh, my Lord.
51.
Yeah, that's right.
That was a show called Flahuli?
That's right. Flahuli.
That is not one of the ones that has come down to us as one of the
great
successes.
It didn't last very long.
Why? Who wrote this?
Yip Harburg.
Not bad.
Directed, and he wrote Sammy Fain. Wrote the music, and Yipper wrote the book with Fred, oh God, I can't think of his last name, Fred Sadie, I think, wrote the book, and it was a delightful score in many ways.
Any songs that we remember?
I don't think so. Hmm. Not unless you're, a Broadway musical aficionado, then there are people who say to me, sing that song from Flahuli. There are a few people who do that.
But it's interesting that we're talking about Yip Harburg, who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow and many other great hits.
Finian's Rainbow.
And Sammy Fain, who wrote some of the greatest hits, and they get together and they produce a musical that doesn't have any memorable songs.
Well, it was about atomic power and about the world situation at the time, and it was during the McCarthy era. And the book of the music was really blasted by the press, so it didn't work.
Yeah, you have been around, as we pointed out, a while.
Definitely.
And I was thinking about the range of songs on the CD going, we have Rainbow Around My Shoulder by Al Jolson, But we also have a Ray Charles song.
Yes, I love that one.
Hallelujah, I love. Well, I would have said I love her so. But and there's cabaret, there's Broadway and pop
and there,
songs.
There are a few Sondheim songs on there too.
And Sondheim. So are these just favorites? Because you must have known thousands and thousands of songs.
Well, I do. Sometimes people send me songs or suggest songs, and I can't do a song just because I like it. It has to fit into whatever theme I've come up with. That's the hardest part, actually.
So is there a theme on this album?
Well, not really. There was a theme. It's that this album is a compilation of a couple of concerts that I did. My 80th birthday concert that I did with the Philharmonic. There were three of those, actually. And there's some of those on this CD.
Well, you're 81 now. Most singers lose a little something over
laughing?
The years. I can't hear any loss. Have you done something? Do you have secrets to keeping the voice? In fact, if anything, having it get richer?
Oh, thank you. Not really. People ask me that all the time, of course. But I must have a really good technique. I had a wonderful teacher, wonderful for me, Robert Cobin, who died a long time ago. And he gave me a very solid technique that I've been using since 1953. So that's 55 years I've been singing like this.
And that was before you probably used microphones most of the time.
That's correct, yeah. Microphones were not on the Broadway stage at that time.
I'm sure that now that you do shows in cabaret, the microphone has really had an effect. You don't have to blast the way you did.
It's great to be able to use the mic for some popular songs, you know, the cabaret-type songs, intimate songs, because then you can honor, I think, the needs of the song better.
Well, Tony Bennett almost makes it a point at least once in every concert to go away from the mic and then just sing to fill Radio City Music Hall.
I do exactly the same thing, and I stole it from Tony Bennett.
Did you?
Yes.
Because you learned how to do that when you started.
Yeah.
You teach master classes at Juilliard.
Well, I teach master classes all over, but I have been doing them at Juilliard a number of times now.
What do you teach there? At Juilliard, I associate with classical music. Were you trained classically?
Well, my teacher felt that his whole technique was based on physiology. And look, we know how sound is produced. There's no mystery there. And he based his whole technique on what he learned about the physical aspects of the larynx. And he felt that this is the way to do it. It's not a mysterious thing, really. And he said, if no matter what you want to do, if you want to be a classical singer or a rock singer or whatever, this is the way to produce sound. So it was up to you what you wanted to do with what he taught you.
And then we see some people who ruin their vocal cords, they get nodes, and others like you who maintain the voice for years and years.
Well, look, I think it's technique, and I'm sure it's technique. And also, genes have got to be in there. And also, you know, if it hurts, I don't do it.
You mentioned Sondheim. When did you first come in contact with him? When you were working on Candide? Because he was brought in, if I remember the history of it correctly, to kind of tinker with Richard Wilbur's lyrics. It was the book by Lillian Hellman.
Not that I know of. I don't think Stephen had anything to do with that first production. The second one with Hal Prince, of course, he had a great deal to do with.
So it was only on the second one.
Yeah, I think so. I don't ever remember hearing anything about that before, and never saw him around.
When did you first?
You know, I don't remember when we met. I've known him so long. I said the other day I must ask him next time I see him. I just don't remember. The first time I was working with him, though, was in the Follies concerts that we did with the Philharmonic in, 1985, I think it was. Heavenly Days.
On this album, you sing No More from Into the Woods.
Into the Woods, yes.
What makes you choose a song? Is it because, for example, I was thinking about Cunegonde, but that had to have been really difficult.
It was.
It was a difficult score.
Well, I'd never sung.
Is that something you liked doing? Do you like the challenge?
do I like the challenge? I remember thinking all along, what the hell have I gotten myself into this time? How did I ever say yes to this? I was afraid, you know, that I was really going to put my foot in it big time. But actually, I was better at it than I thought I would be.
It was your big break. Well, you'd done other things, but that was the thing that really made the difference for you.
If I had not studied with Robert Coben, there's no way on earth I would have gotten the job in the first place, and there's no way I would have been able to do that. And, you know, I sang with lots and lots of high notes in the score, that first score that Lenny wrote for the role of Kunigunda. And I did it 8 times a week. There were 21 high C's written for that role.
Wow.
So on a matinee day, I sang 20, because the last one, everybody's singing, I opened my mouth and acted like I was singing a high C. So I did 20 in each performance. So on matinee days, I was singing 40 high C's. Wow. And 8 E flats over high C, and 32 B flats. I mean, it was just outrageous what he wrote for that role.
Was he difficult to work with?
Oh, my Lord, no. Exactly the opposite. He was wonderful to work with.
So
Very supportive.
So there you were. I mean, you became a big star on Broadway. And then you had a second career. What happened?
Well, I got older, for one thing. And the Broadway stage took a kind of slump at that point. And I don't know, I think I needed to just stop working for a while too, but I wouldn't have been able to just do it, because I would have felt guilty. So what happened is that I decided for some reason, every script they sent me, there's something wrong with it. And then several years later, I looked at the script, I came across and I thought, you know, this is not so bad, why didn't I do this? I think I just needed to stop for a while.
You came back doing concerts and doing cabaret, and you've been pretty much doing that ever since. Is it that different?
Look, I don't want to skip over the part of my being an alcoholic, too. I mean, that had a little bit to do with my disappearing from the scene for a couple of years. I was really not employable.
But do you think that we understand why people might not want to hire somebody who is unreliable, because she might be drunk at any given moment?
Well,
do you think that it gave you insight into the kind of approach you've had to songs since? You know, I mean, having had a rough time?
I think so, sure. I think so. You know, and when you get to be a certain age, if you haven't had a rough time of some kind, you're not trying hard enough. You're not risking enough, perhaps.
But experience is important, and somebody who starts young and then just has a career take off, sometimes they've actually lost certain kinds of experiences.
Well, maybe. It's a hell of a way to get experience, I'll tell you. I have felt bad about that through the years, because at the time when I probably should have been doing my best work on Broadway, I was not able to do it. And my son, who's really quite wise about these things, has said a wonderful thing to me. He said, Mom, this was your journey. And he said, if you hadn't experienced that, you wouldn't be who you are today. And who you are right now is pretty damn good.
And maybe you wouldn't have celebrated your 80th birthday singing with the New York Philharmonic.
Who knows?
But that had to be a thrill.
It was. Oh, and they went so well that, you know, so many people came, and the response was just great.
When you look at what's on Broadway today, there are a lot of revivals. They're actually the kinds of shows that you could have appeared in during those lost years, in some cases shows that you may have appeared in. Do you feel an itch to go back ever?
Not now, I think, because I don't think I would want to be. When you're trying out a new show, you rehearse in the daytime and play at night. And that's a very difficult time. So I'm not sure I would want to do that now.
Yesterday I spoke to Judy Collins about taking somebody else's song and making it your own. Well, what do you do with a song? Well, I guess most people don't remember Al Jolson singing Rainbow Around My Shoulder, but...
I do. And I loved Al Jolson.
What do you do? Because when I even hear the name of the song, I hear his voice in my head. How do you get past that?
I don't know. I don't think about it. I just... if you worry about how somebody else sang something, you're in trouble, I think. I just investigate the text, and the hard decision, of course, is this a song I want to do? Can I stand behind this? Does this song say something I want to say? And do I need it in the lineup of songs? Do I need it for this show? So those are the things you have to decide. And then I just try to put my life's blood into it.
But do you think basically that because you have been an actor as well, that it helps you in the end? Is making a song your own kind of like making a part your own?
Well, when you talk about the acting aspect of it, I didn't realize how much I approached songs as an actress until people told me that I did that. And it wasn't something I did consciously. It was just my way of working. And it's part of, I think, what helps me handle my nerves, because I get scared all the time. And if I'm really involved in this emotional journey and musical journey that I've set for myself, then I'm less frightened.
Well, why are you frightened? You've had great success, and people have cheered you night after night after night. Do you never get past that?
Gee, Doc, I don't know why. I don't know.
Well, I've always been nervous. 50 minutes to spare later. Maybe we can discuss it. My rates are very low.
I've always been a kind of nervous person about stuff like that. Yeah. Well, now to oh, God, I hate it. I forget words now and then. I forget that. Forget lyrics.
Ella Fitzgerald did. She did okay.
I know. A lot of people do. And people tell me when I forget that it's okay. It doesn't bother them, but it bothers me.
What,
it doesn't happen all the time. I get attacks, you know. Suddenly, I'll go for months without forgetting anything. Then suddenly it happens.
Yeah, if there's a song that you probably forget and you're performing at a place like Feinstein's, I'm sure nobody would care if you put a little lyric sheet in front of yourself.
I find that doesn't work for me. You know, some people put up a little music stand, even in cabaret, but I don't know how to do that.
Will we be seeing you anytime soon?
You know why I don't? Because what I try to do is, for the moment, live within that song. And you can't very well live within a song when you got one eye out for this little piece of paper over here.
Mm.
So it doesn't work for me.
Will we be seeing you perform live soon in New York?
I think I'll maybe going into the Carlisle in the spring.
Oh, great.
The spring of next year.
Meanwhile, we have this CD called Rainbow Round My Shoulder. And we're going to go out with the title song, Al Jolson's composition. I don't know if he wrote a lot of songs. I always thought he sang other people's songs.
Who knows how much he had to do with this, but...
He got the credit.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us again, Barbara.
Thank you very much.
I'm happy, so happy, walking on air. The why and the wherefore is someone I care for.